In the movie Dumb and Dumber, it was hard at times to tell which of the two utter morons was dumb and which was dumber. Talk about your unhelpful friends. At least Job didn't have someone saying, "Do you want to hear a really annoying noise?" Yeah, when you've reached a certain point of cluelessness, it's questionable whether, you know, such fine distinctions are useful anyway. We have heard from only one of Job's friends through the first seven chapters of this book. Now we hear from a second. Bildad the Shuhite will join Eliphaz in presenting counsel to this suffering man. We've already seen that the first acquaintance was wrong in what he had to say, in the thrust of his speech. Bildad now shows us that he might have to be considered even wronger. And we can hardly wait to hear from Zophar, who I suppose we will have to term wrongerer. Bildad has been impatiently waiting his turn to jump on Job for his outrageous words. He had to show respect for his elder Eliphaz's right to go first and allow Job to respond to that. But he is all over this discussion as soon as he can get a word in with any kind of decorum. What we find is that he is Eliphaz, only more so. There are many of the same elements of indisputable truth in his speech. There is again the fact that if this were addressed to a different person in a different context, we might be lauding the forthrightness of his counsel. But the actual upshot here is admonition even more hurtful to Job. I think even more useful to the enemy and its discouraging possibilities than what had come before. Bildad has even greater zeal. Okay, well, that often comes with greater youth. He really feels like he knows what Job needs, but this youthful zeal only leads him to be more insulting. And this will get even worse, actually, when we get to chapter 18. In his passion to protect God's justice, Bildad becomes a ruthless attacker of the very person that he believes he is helping. Once again, we see how damaging a well-meaning person can be when his only desire, it seems, is to talk, to correct, to instruct, not listen. We have the impression that Bildad was not weighing what Job was saying. He was only thinking about what he could say as soon as he had the opportunity. He did not think that he really needed to hear Job, because he already knew what was the solution to Job's distress, his difficulties. So what we get here is more rapid-fire condescension that only drives Job further into despair. I've divided our passage into the two main areas in which Bildad was wronger. We begin in verses 2 through 7 and then 20 through 22 with the mistaken application of God's justice to this situation. Verses 2 through 7. How long will you say these things and the words of your mouth be a mighty wind? Does God pervert justice, or does the Almighty pervert what is right? If your sons sinned against him, then he delivered them into the power of their transgression. If you would seek God and implore the compassion of the Almighty, if you are pure and upright, surely now he would rouse himself for you and restore your righteous estate. Though your beginning was insignificant, yet your end will increase greatly. And then going down to 20, lo, God will not reject a man of integrity, nor will he support the evildoers. He will yet fill your mouth with laughter and your lips with shouting. Those who hate you will be clothed with shame, and the tent of the wicked will be no longer. Well, how do you like verse 2 as an opener? The first words that we hear from Bildad, how long are you going to keep going along with this? It is obviously, you know, I can hardly bear to hear this. Do you sense how sure of himself Bildad, you know, must have been, for these to be his first words to Job? I mean, he had to be pretty confident that he had Job's number, that he had really read this situation, right? There's no caution at all. You know, no self-doubt here. He just plows forward. No probing of any other possibilities that could explain what he has heard from Job. He just knows that this man is way off base, and he proceeds on that basis. There's more here than simply calling Job a windbag and asking how long he's going to go on like this. That would be bad enough, I believe, if he just immediately took that tack. But he is picturing Job's words as a destructive windstorm. Okay, well, what does that bring to your mind? What killed Job's sons and daughter? And I don't think that allusion was unintentional in the light of verse 4. Bildad does not have any idea that his words are actually the more damaging ones in God's sight. What's interesting to me right off here is that Job had already said that his words belong to the wind back in 6:26. Remember that? Do you intend to reprove my words when the words of one in despair belong to the wind? He'd already put that out there. He, you know, had already in that sense sort of confessed where he was coming from. And I think he was inviting his friends to get past to a degree that despair that was present in his speeches, to truly investigate what it was that he was dealing with. But Bildad had decided to pick up on this phrase that Job himself had brought up and to use it against him. He's saying basically, you are a complete blowhard, Job, and you ought to be ashamed of yourself. This is something that often happens when people are in conflict. Sometimes the admissions that we have previously made get flung back at us. That's kind of a tough one, isn't it? This used to happen to my dad all the time. He would, because he was a guileless man, an honest man, a sensitive man, he would confess a certain insecurity, you know, just thing that he struggled with to another person in the leadership. And then, you know, later, whenever he had a difference of opinion with that person, he would hear about, well, that was just his, you know, insecurities popping up. Now pastor, you know, It's your own problem that's causing you to disagree with me. Don't you see? That kind of thing makes you think twice about being as vulnerable and transparent as people are always assuring you that you should be, you know, just open up, just tell it to, you know, let us really see you and, you know, warts and all. And I'm not saying that that's a bad thing, but often that kind of stuff can come back and people use it in fleshly ways. And that seems to be what's happening here. You know, Job's trying to communicate that, yeah, he knows that a lot of this is, you know, just, you know, stuff that shouldn't be taken completely, seriously. That it's, you know, he's kind of blowing off some steam, so to speak. But Bildad's gonna really hold his feet to the fire. It's in verse 3 that we find the main theme of Bildad's presentation. He pounces on the fact that Job was questioning God's justice. Does God pervert justice? Where are you going with this, Job? This is completely beyond the pale. And Job was indeed struggling with how God was acting justly in giving him such horrible circumstances. That is the crux of his problem. It's not that he thinks that God is not just, but he can't square things right now. And the irony is that his friends were only egging on, you know, that perplexity that he had with their own mistaken perspective on God's justice. They were kind of keeping him in a bad place as far as trying to figure out how all of this was working in his own life. Job has not actually accused God of being unjust to this point. As I was talking about this morning, when we get to chapter 9, you know, boy, you know, things are going to get a little off base there. He knows that God wouldn't pervert justice, but he's trying to reconcile what he knows of God and how God is acting in this particular instance. Job knew himself to be innocent, not, you know, without sin, but that this was not a response to some sin in his life. And yet he was apparently being punished. If what his friends were saying was true, what could explain this? Being punished, being treated in this way by God when there wasn't any specific charge that could be brought against him. Bildad's words will only inflame Job's sense that something is really off here. It's the same old cause and effect, isn't it, that Bildad presents here. He's even saying that God's justice was being upheld in Job's suffering. Can't you see how just God is by what's going on in your life? Well, that's the very area where he couldn't understand it. Job had clearly sinned. And now he was paying the consequences for that. How dare he ask questions about that and seem to impugn God's character? And we get the family dragged back into it in verse 4. Tough words. Wow. Bildad thinly disguises what he thinks happened with the word if, but come on. His whole understanding of the ways of God demands that Job's sons must have sinned for something so decisively destructive, something just so obviously, you know, coming from God to have taken place. They were simply reaping what they had sowed with their sinful behavior. How this idea, these words must have grieved Job. Was it possible that he had a hand in sin that was so great that God had to react to it in this way? Ha- you know, had he failed so miserably in everything that he had tried to accomplish with his family? Remember, he was doing things that I believe would have just stood out, you know, remarkably in the surrounding culture. Those sacrifices that he had made, the family worship times, the instruction every day on the first day of the week, every morning. The first day of the week they had come together. Was that all for nothing? Was that all somehow masking, you know, terrible sin that they'd all been involved in that God had to eradicate? We would all wonder whether it would be good to speak like Bildad here, even if it were true. I'm not sure that this would be the way to go about this, even if it were true. Should our initial words, future words, be that a person's loved ones died because of their sins? Whatever conclusion we come to, Bildad was wrong about what had happened. He was just completely wrong. He should never have been voicing these suggestions. Sin had nothing to do with why that tornado took the lives of Job's children. And Job suspects this. He feels it, you know, in his spirit and in his bones. That's not what was going on. But he can't figure out an alternative explanation at this point. His friends are giving him only two options. Either God acted arbitrarily, which is impossible, and you can't even go there, or he had been compelled by his own just character to punish sin. In their framework, that's all that there is. And the one can't happen. So, where are you, Job? You're stuck with door number two. Nothing makes sense to Job, and these hurtful words only deepen his anguish. Verses 5 through 7, and then down 20 through 22, they emphasize the same project that Eliphaz had laid out. These guys cannot rest until Job has confessed his sin. You know, can't you see, Job, where you're just a few words away, this close to just turning it all around? Why won't you just do it? Why are we still here? We're going on and on and back and forth, and they'll continue to do that, and it would just be so easy to just resolve it all. Just come out with it. He needed to confess a sin. He needed to seek God. Well, he was seeking God. He was looking to God, asking God, and so forth. He was doing that, just not in the way that they thought that he should be. That's not the right way to go to God, Job. You're off. Bildad tells Job to seek God's mercy, you know, and get his act together, basically, and then all would be well. We can all shake hands and we can go home and live happily ever after. The idea that one could be righteous before God and still suffer is no more a possibility in Bildad's mind that one could do wrong and not suffer. those two ideas just didn't compute. And it's kind of interesting for those who prided themselves on what experience taught them, what they could see going on around them. This was kind of a strange way for Job's friends to view what was happening. I mean, is this really what experience teaches us? That righteous people can never suffer and that people who are wicked can never prosper? More on that down the road. We're going to get into that whole subject. But it's just odd to me, you know, even right here that they seem to be so locked into these categories that did not actually really fit experience all that well. I do not know what Bildad is getting at as far as the insignificant beginning of Job. That's in verse 7, though your beginning was insignificant. Kind of wrestled with that. Nobody really seemed to give me a particularly good thought on that. Obviously, Job had not been insignificant before his trials ever came. He was, you know, the greatest man of the East or whatever the exact phrase was. He was a prominent man. Perhaps he's talking about Job's current situation now as the starting point. Okay, now, right now, you're at the bottom, which of course was true from the human perspective. But there was a complete confidence that all of that misery could be turned, again, to prosperity and joy if Job will only humble himself and confess his sin. Like Eliphaz, Bildad spoke in a sense kind of prophetically here. You know, they both talked about how his future, you know, could just be wonderful and even better and so forth than it was now. And that's going to turn out to be certainly true, but they're saying that for all the wrong reasons. The friends were holding out only one hope to Job. This is your only hope. And it was one that made no sense to him. So if your only hope is something that just you absolutely cannot reconcile yourself to, then where are you? You don't have any hope. But there was other hope available that had yet to be revealed. So we move to the second matter that Bildad was wrong about, even wronger, and that was the value of man's wisdom in this situation. Man's wisdom, verses 8 through 19. Please inquire of past generations. And consider the things searched out by their fathers. For we are only of yesterday and know nothing. Because our days on earth are as a shadow. Will they not teach you and tell you and bring forth words from their minds? Can the papyrus grow up without a marsh? Can the rushes grow without water? While it is still green and not cut down, yet it withers before any other plant. So are the paths of all who forget God. And the hope of the godless will perish, whose confidence is fragile and whose trust a spider's web. He trusts in his house, but it does not stand. He holds fast to it, but it does not endure. He thrives before the sun and his shoots spread out over his garden. His roots wrap around a rock pile. He grasps a house of stones. If he is removed from his place, then it will deny him, saying, I never saw you. Behold, this is the joy of his way, and out of the dust others will spring. Remember that in chapter 4, Eliphaz felt that he needed some persuasive support for his words on cause and effect. So, you know, he played the experience card. That's what he resorted to. He was sure that his vision in the night and all of its implications would seal Job's lips once and for all. You know, that would just be, you know, the final argument. Didn't work out that way. Job was not impressed by that line of argumentation. Now, Bildad is, you know, building on that effort. He's in the same area. This argument also involves experience, but more the combined experience of those who had since passed from the scene. In other words, Bildad is appealing to tradition. He's appealing to the traditional wisdom of their forebears. If Job would not listen to his friends, which it seemingly is stubbornly, digging in his heels in the face of their incredible wisdom, well, okay, then Job would just have to get told by the ancestors, because they were saying the same thing. They would agree with their sayings and so forth in what Eliphaz and Bildad were saying. It does not appear that Bildad is referring to God's word passed down through the generations here. We don't get anything about that. These are the home truths that men had come up with through their observations. These were time-honored sayings and illustrations that supported Bildad's contention that Job must be at fault for these difficulties to have come upon him. This kind of wisdom is common. It's kind of folk wisdom, we could say. Often it should be considered. I mean, there is a reason why certain things do persist through the generations. It's usually helpful for run-of-the-mill activities, but it tends to be lacking when applied to uncommon circumstances, such as Job's. Bildad gives three pictures that he believes are a perfect fit for Job. You know, he's nailed this. The first is the papyrus plant, which grows in the Nile Delta of Egypt. Most famously, it does even grow in some marshes in Israel today. I don't know if you came across that, but it's still around and grows kind of a beautiful plant. It grows tall and luxuriant as long as it is connected to its source in the rich mud. But without plentiful water, it will wither before any other type of grass-like plant. I mean, it's going to be the first to go in a drought kind of a situation. Job was like that reed when deprived of its resources. He had looked great one day. He had grown tall and flowered. And then suddenly his life had withered. Why? Because he had forgotten God. He'd forgotten God. So clear. Again, Bildad speaks in an oblique fashion in verse 13, kind of trying to veil it a little bit. He does not blatantly class Job with the godless, but he wants him to consider whether he was joining their ranks with his sin, with his lack of repentance. What is this really saying, Job? It seemed that Job was no longer connected to the one who would nourish his life. What else could explain what was going on? In New Testament terms, he's saying, the branch is not connected to the vine, Job. He could expect to perish, just as his sons back in verse 4. Verses 14 and 15 give a second illustration. Job was like a spider, which is not necessarily great right there, depending on your view of spiders, but Job was like a spider who trusted in its web to withstand all potential damage. But such a web cannot last more than a season, and it's liable to be torn by whatever large object comes into contact with it. You know, we might not like it very much when we walk through a spider web. And you have such a hard time getting it all off of you and so forth. And we don't like that when it sticks to us. But the web does not survive the encounter. It's done. Job had trusted that what he had labored so long to build, he had spun this very impressive life. He thought it would last, and it had been torn up in a day. His flocks, his crops, his buildings, his family, it all been shown to be as insubstantial as the gossamer spun by a spider. He had trusted in his own strength. He had not trusted in the Lord. And it had cost him. This illustration is somewhat reminiscent of Jesus' parable about building on the sand or building on the rock. Job had built on the sand, and when the storm came, his house went splat. Finally, Bildad turns to the analogy of a garden plant in verses 16 through 19. This is apparently one of those creeping vines that spread quickly across the surface of the ground. It can make a very impressive display when it flowers, and it's covering a pretty big area, and it's kind of like, wow. But it is attached mostly to rocks. It's not truly anchored deep in the soil. It's easily removed. And when it is, there's little mark that it had ever flourished there. Sort of like Jesus' parable of the soils, isn't it? The seed that falls on the rocky places, it looks good when it sprouts up, has no root though really in it, and dies quickly. Job's former prosperity had looked good, but it had no staying power because it was not established with God and by God. We might not be able to grasp in our culture the devastating strength of Bildad saying this about his not having a place. There's much emphasis in the Old Testament literature on having a place, a secure place, a settled inheritance, okay, on the earth that could not be contested or you know, taken away. For your place to not know you or not know that you were there, you know, for you not to be there anymore, that was considered to be a terrible tragedy. We see that in verse 7:10. He will not return again to his house, nor will his place know him anymore. There's a lot in that, emotionally for the person of this time and place. Chapter 8, verse 6, he says, if you are pure and upright, surely now he will rouse himself for you and restore your righteous estate. The wicked are described elsewhere in the Old Testament scriptures as those that you will look for and they won't be around anymore. They'll be gone from their place on the earth. You know, the whole idea of inheriting the earth, the idea that you're going to have your place while others are removed, that's really big. The wicked are removed, the righteous remain. So for Bildad to say that Job was essentially being plucked off of the earth by God so that another could take his place, that's just a very harsh thing to say. Out of the dust, others will spring. You're being replaced, Job, because of your sin. We see from verse 20 that these illustrations were all tied to the cause and effect mentality of the three friends. God would not bring all of this trouble upon a man of integrity, a man who was blameless. That just didn't happen. and he would not strengthen an evildoer. So, what did that mean for Job's position with God? He was meant to see, again, that repentance of sin was his only hope. But what were the two key blunders of Bildad? Again, the first one, Job was blameless. God himself, we want to keep reminding ourselves, had said so. He'd made a point of it. He had trumpeted that truth to Satan. Have you seen this blameless man? That this could be the case. That Job could actually be a righteous man, that has never been part of this discussion. So all of these illustrations were worthless. It had been assumed from the beginning that this was all about Job's sin, and so he's coming up with these examples and so forth to show, you know, what this cause and effect situation is all about. Didn't apply. And then second, an honest evaluation of Job's life would have then opened up other possibilities for this disaster. But that would have led to the thought that God could indeed bring great suffering upon a righteous man. That would have been an idea even harder for Bildad and his friends to digest than that Job was blameless. They struggled truly with the one, but to go to the other, that God could bring great suffering to a righteous man, they couldn't go there, and that is an idea that most today cannot stomach. And obviously that's true of unbelievers, but I'm talking even among the world of professing Christians. How many can stomach the thought that God would bring great suffering to a righteous person? But without these two truths in play, who Job really was and how God can really act, Bildad is doomed to give Job a comfort that is pure torture. I'm sure that we would all wish to avoid playing that kind of a role in someone's life. You hate to think of yourself as the Bildad, you know, coming in and just adding to the problem. I'm going to conclude with several suggestions from Stephen Lawson about how we could listen more carefully than Bildad did when someone is speaking about their pain, and so perhaps be a better counselor, a better help. See, four things here. First, we should not dominate the conversation. Do not dominate the conversation. And this is listen more than speak. Think about what is behind a person's words. Do not begin formulating what you want to say before the person is finished. That will guarantee that you are not paying attention to their words. If you're already thinking about, well, this is what I want to say. This is what I think that they need to hear. So I'm just going to think about how well I'm going to put that. And it doesn't really matter what this person is prattling on about. Often the greatest respect that you can show for someone's thoughts is to go away and think about them before responding at all. That can be kind of a weird thought. because we, you know, for various reasons, either you want to or you think you're supposed to just, hey, I've got it. Here, you know. Here's my wisdom, just, you know, it's just right here and ready. But maybe you need to think about it. Listen. Second, express sympathy for the pain that the person is going through. Express sympathy. Say, I'm sorry that you were going through such a tough time. And mean it. We never hear that from these men, do we? Never hear anything close to that. We remember the first actions, and as we go along, it's almost as if those actions become less commendable in our eyes, because we almost wonder, why were they doing that? Maybe there was more of an element of sorrow over Job's sin than what he was going through. But as far as what they've had to say, no sympathy. When somebody tells you what they're going through, do not feel the need to top it with your own story. Got plenty of toppers around. Don't feel like you need to detract from it as if it was really nothing. Simply show some understanding that this is indeed a challenge for this person. Maybe it wouldn't be for you. That's not the point, is it? Next, keep yourself from interrupting. I felt no conviction when I came up with this application. Keep yourself from interrupting. Wait until the other person's train of thought has come fully into the station. And that can be hard. Especially when we're pressed for time, or we're sure we see what's going on. Sometimes we jump in when someone is, you know, considering how to put something, or they're trying to remember something, and we're like, come on, you know, let's move along with this. But a lot of things that are really tough are not easily expressed, and take some time and some patience. You know, we can jump in there before a person's done, and then when that person resumes what they were trying to say, we think that person's interrupting us. But we never really let them get it out. Sometimes it can be good to ask, are you finished? And not with the kind of tone that could be applied to that question. But in a sincere and gentle way, is that all that you wanted to communicate? And then fourth, wait to make corrections or hard statements until you've heard all the facts that might be relevant. You might need to hear from more than one person to do this, but do not make an evaluation when there could be more to a matter than meets the eye. And I'm going to throw in a fifth one here that relates to this, but we could separate it as a last pointer here. Ask probing questions. And that's, again, something that these guys don't do. They talk about investigating, and, you know, they've thoroughly thought this out and through and looked at it from every side, and they didn't do anything. And it can be convicting at times to just ask yourself, when was the last time I sat with a person and just ask them questions about their lives. Because I was interested, because I was concerned, because what they were going through was important to go over, I just asked them questions about what they were going through or about what they were experiencing. Not even in a crisis situation, I'm saying, just to know who they were. People don't do that, by the way, okay? People do not care about what's going on in other people's lives, really. They can't get their minds off themselves long enough to sustain a series of questions about another person's life. They can't do it. That's a very, very sad thing. It's a very sad thing for a Christian not to have that as part of the tool bag. It takes some discernment, yes, to do that. It takes some humility to do that. It takes some real care to do that. You have to actually, think about, well, what could shed light on this problem or just on this person's life or, on our relationship? And you have to accept that, you might not have immediate answers for many things that could come up in that. So get information that could be useful. Bildad asks a few questions in chapter 8 here. But look at the questions. I mean, they're all rhetorical. He's not really trying to explore anything that's going on in Job. He's not saying, what's going on in your heart and in your mind? How are you thinking about this? He is not interested in what's at the core of Job's perplexity. And Job knew that he was missing something here, but Bildad could not imagine that this situation might defy all the models that he had. It was Bildad who actually had the most to learn here. That's one of the great ironies here, but he was in lecture mode. He was not in learning mode. Let's try to be in a learning mode. I'm sure that we don't want to be even wrong in our counsel, let alone wronger. So let's ask God for the grace to be good listeners. Lord, this is part of our living out of Philippians 2, that humility where we regard one another as more important than ourselves. We don't want to merely look after our own personal interests, but also look after the interests of others. So may we listen to you first, but also may we listen to and sympathize with others. We ask this in Jesus' name, amen.